friends, you're listening to season two of Draws in Spanish. If this is your first time listening, welcome. I'm Fabiola. I'm your host. I'm an illustrator and podcaster based here in Philly. And on Draws in Spanish, I chat with Latinx visual artists and designers to discuss everything from their identity and culture to their creative process and work. Today on the show, we have Mexican-American multidisciplinary artist Tamara Santibáñez. Tamara is a New York-based tattoo artist, writer, and oral historian who brings their experience in social justice work to their creative and body modification practice. They believe that the best tattooing happens when it's trauma-informed and justice-centered. If you want to watch Tamara and I chat today, you can also watch the video version of this episode over on my YouTube channel. Just search for Draws and Spanish in the YouTube app and it should come up. Or if you rather, just click the link in the show notes, whatever's easier for you. Tamara has a fine line black and gray tattoo style that is very much inspired by Chicanx traditional tattooing, which originated from the prison system. I'm so excited to talk to them today, so stay tuned to hear us talk all about how they grew up in Georgia, why they chose to go back to school for oral history, and their approach to tattooing and painting. Okay, let's go, guys. Let's get into the show. Hi, Tamara. How are you doing? I'm so excited to have you on the show today. What's up with you?
Hi. I'm so excited to be here, too. What's up with me is that it's so hot. I am in Brooklyn, and it's probably about 100 degrees. Like, that's not an exaggeration. I'm in my studio right now, and there is AC, but I think AC's, you know, the city over are struggling today. So sweating, trying to get a little work done.
Yes, I feel you. I went out today, it was 100, and then on my phone it said like feels like 105. So it's so hot today. I'm in Philly. I don't know if you know that I'm in Philly now, but so yeah, it's just as similarly hot. But okay, so I want listeners to know that Tam and I are friends. We've met before through a mixture of mutual friends in New York. And even though we've hung out before, we've never really like talked deeply about much. Just because, you know, when you're out and about, it's not really the scenario. So I'm so excited to talk about your work today. One of the first things I want to ask you about and talk to you about is I can't believe you had an interview with Maria Hinojosa from Latino USA. Wow, huge moment. Congrats to you. And, you know, today's interview is going to be a little bit more casual than that, but I hope it's just as like fun for both of us.
Oh, thank you. So, I mean, I have to say that the interview wasn't with Maria Hinojosa. I was interviewed by someone else that works for Latino USA, which was really wonderful. She was a really wonderful interviewer. And it wasn't until hearing the final episode that I got to hear. I mean, I definitely got a little bit of a thrill, you know, hearing Maria Hinojosa say my name. I was like, ooh, longtime listener, first time participant. So yeah, that was a really special moment. And I think, you know, my family and like my friends who are fans of the show too, it was really cool to be able to be on it.
Yes, that is so exciting. I mean, I think the woman who wrote the actual article, at least for your episode, was Alejandra Salazar.
Yes, that's who interviewed me.
Salazar. Yeah. So I'm assuming that's who interviewed. Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Shout out to that. Of course, I listened to it, of course. And so I'm excited, even more pumped to talk to you today. So I just wanted to start things off with a little bit about like your upbringing and your home life. So can you give us like a picture of where you grew up? Just like what that scenario was like, because I feel like that's always helpful for people who want to be tattoo artists, want to be have a creative career, to kind of like know that there's people from all different backgrounds going into it, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So I guess to give you a little bit of background, my mom is an immigrant from Mexico. My dad is an American. So my mom immigrated when they got married. And my dad is a professor. So we lived in a couple of different college towns when I was really young, when my parents were still together. So we ended up in Athens, Georgia, which is a college town. The University of Georgia is there. And we stayed there after my parents divorced. So, you know, I was pretty young when that happened. And then after that, grew up with my mom, which was, you know, really wonderful. She's a really hardworking woman, you know, providing for three kids. And we did a lot of, I mean, I feel really fortunate to have grown up in a household that was very, you know, proud of our culture and where that was really represented in our daily life, whether it was like the foods that we were cooking or, you know, being a Spanish speaking household and making sure that we had family visiting or going to visit family in Mexico as much as we could. So that I'm really grateful for. And other than that, I mean, I do feel like I grew up in a family that really supported creativity and creative explorations. And yeah, definitely. I loved to draw since I was a really young kid. I loved to read since I was a really young kid. And so that was a big part of my life from early childhood.
Amazing. I love that. Like, you know, I don't love that your mom was a single mom. Like, obviously that, you know, is tough. But I also had a single mom. So in that case, I love it because I'm like, yes, we're like, you know, raised by strong women. That's always like has a really huge influence in what you do. So I love that. And then can you tell me about like what baby Tamara was drawing, was into? Because I feel like, you know, I know who you are now. I know like the kind of work that you're putting out now. But I'm just a little curious, like what those first influences were or like interests?
Wow. I think like most kids, we watched a lot of Disney. We watched a lot of animated things. So the first things I can really distinctly remember drawing were like mermaids and princesses, animals, things like that. My mom still has that kind of stuff around. And then I think, you know, as you get older, you think that the measure of being a good artist is being able to draw representationally or draw from life. So trying to do like still lives or trying to do portraits of my friends and doing like life drawing, sketching. I was doing a lot of that for sure.
Oh, I love that. I feel like, you know, it's kind of universal of an experience, but I love it so much because it's so like innocent, like pre trying to make anything out of it, just like trying to like draw what you think is cool is such a like genuine phase. You're just like, yeah, this is freaking cool. I just love it. Okay. And then, so you grew up in Athens, Georgia, and you had your Mexican mom. How did you kind of fall into kind of this influence of Chicanx? I don't know. Actually, I want to ask you, should I say Chicano, Chicanx, Chican? I'm not sure.
I mean, I think you could say either. I think you could say either one. Personally, I think depending on how like specific you want to be about gender inclusivity. But yeah, I mean, I think that there were so many of those. Like, there's so many images of Chicano art that are so like just in the canon and in that kind of like. There's like a really familiar visual lexicon, and I think that familiarity is part of why it resonates with people so deeply. It's because you're like, oh my god, I grew up seeing this, or like I have such deep early memories of this kind of imagery, whether it's like a calendar that you had on the wall from the like local Mexican restaurant, or whether it's like you know, like the laundromat would give out calendars that had like the you know, some like really beautiful classical illustrations, or like going to the market and they have like the sticker vending machine that has like car decals. That's like smile now, cry later, or like the packaging on foods, you know, like it's so immersed, those representations. And so that's definitely, I think, the early memories of it. I didn't grow up seeing a lot of tattoos where I lived necessarily. But then, you
that's
know,
what I was curious about,
yeah,
just like, cause
yeah.
I know you grew up in Athens, Georgia, like how were you exposed to Chicano tattoo art and that imagery being in Athens, Georgia?
I would say maybe not to the tattooing specifically at that point. I got a lot more involved in tattoo culture when I was, you know, when I was a teenager. I went to college when I was 17 and, I was living in Savannah, Georgia. I had a lot of friends that worked at tattoo shops and friends who were getting tattooed and like working as assistants and learning to tattoo at that time. A lot of friends who were in bands. And so, I mean, I was so into punk culture and like heavy metal culture, and tattooing was a huge part of that because it was so subcultural. I mean, tattooing is very mainstream now. Like all different kinds of people have tattoos. But at that time and in that place specifically, you know, punk tattooing was so exciting. And that was kind of what a lot of the people who I knew in that world were doing. So they were like, played in bands, but were also learning to tattoo. Or they like were tattoo artists, but they were always at all the shows. And so, yeah, I would say it was more when I moved to New York and started working in tattoo shops, that I started to really see a wider range of tattoo art, and started to connect with the more West Coast style.
Yeah. Was there a moment where, okay, so you're like seeing all this, you know, I'm going to say general tattoo culture at the time. Was there a point where you were exposed to specifically Chicano tattoo style that then you were like, oh, I want to know more about that? Or did you know, like, I'm just curious how you just were exposed to that specific style once you were already interested in tattooing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I had seen examples of that tattooing, but I think I didn't quite put it together that it was like such a specific style in the tattoo world, like in the professional tattoo industry, because it's so prevalent on the West Coast, but I grew up in the Southeast. So, you know, it was more, I think once I was in a tattoo space there, I mean, there wasn't that many representations of it, even in the tattoo shop that I was working in. And partially it was like friends that I had who were from the West Coast and had tattooed on the West Coast that were like, oh, like if you like this, like check this other artist out. Or if you like this, like you'll love this. Or like, if you're interested in drawing this kind of script, like you should be looking at these people. Because, you know, the internet was not what it is now. Like social media wasn't what it is now. Like now, I think because of those things, that style has just spread so and exploded globally. So you have like people in Italy that are doing Chicano style tattooing. You have people in Japan that are doing Chicano style tattooing. But back then that was, you know, before Instagram, before those things. So I remember I would be following like all of the individual websites and like individual blogs. Like I would always look at the Lowrider tattoo blog and read like about Jose Lopez's work. And you kind of had to like really know about the individual things, even like things like Teen Angels magazine, you know, like wasn't a collectible then. So you could still find them really inexpensively. And so I started collecting things like that. And like, just, I'm a researcher too and a collector. So I was like, if I had like a Teen Angels magazine, I was like, oh, let me
just
see
like
what other publications.
All the way through.
Yeah, exactly. And just, you know, making more and more friends that were more based in California or like were from the West Coast and were more involved. And so, kind of like, and then starting to work out in LA myself, and feeling very embraced and feeling very, very welcomed. But I remember, you know, feeling really distinctly like, oh, this is so cool because this is a really specifically Mexican American tattoo culture. And that it was just nice to have a personal connection with that imagery and that history and to have it be repeating images that were so familiar from my childhood in tattooing specifically. Because, you know, tattoos like traditional Americana wasn't really, I just didn't have a personal connection with.
So you mentioned this for a split second, you know, like tattooing is such a male dominated field and it has to be so hard to kind of make a space for yourself in that industry. And you've been able to do it. So my question for you is, how has it been for you to work in a male dominated space and seen it evolve over the years? Because I know you've been tattooing now for like over 13 years. So how has it been for you?
That's a good question. I mean, I have a lot of complicated feelings about it, and tattooing has changed a lot in that time. I mean, when I first came into the industry, my experience sort of politically was as a woman, but, you know, I'm a non-binary person and a gender non-conforming person. And that, you know, coming out as that has also been different and been a part of, I think, the greater shift in the culture to be more inclusive. Because when I got into tattooing, I just didn't see a lot of, like, you know, even women, let alone trans or non-binary people, and, you know, and not openly queer people either necessarily. And so I think at the time I was really in some ways, unbeknownst to me, like attracted to the masculinity in that culture, because it was, the expectation was that you would assimilate to that. And so in some ways it gave me permission to access a more masculine aspect of myself as like a trans mask person. And I didn't really realize at the time that that's why that felt that way to me, or that's why I was attracted to like punk or metal or goth or tattooing or all these cultures that kind of enabled different expressions of femininity or womanness. And I think at the time, that's what I thought it was me kind of like butting up against the what was allowed in womanness and not being like, actually, I'm just not a woman. But now tattooing is so much more expansive in terms of representation and in terms of who is allowed and who is able to really shine. And I think that that has to do with a few things. I think it has to do with the internet. First of all, you know, people can advertise themselves and build a clientele and not be so reliant on tattoo shops to be bringing them clients. People can kind of seek out individual artists, I think, is more how people are connecting with people to be tattooed by. And I think people are also more intentional about seeking out artists whose identity they resonate with. So some people are like, I really do want to go to a woman artist, or I really do want to go to like another trans person. And that is really cool that there's so many options now, because it is a different experience for sure. And that's not to be gender essentialist about it, because I also get really frustrated by those things where people are like, oh, a woman artist is like inherently a safer, kinder person, because there's like sexism and gender bias inherent in that too. But I think it's cool to be able to go to artists who are so vocal and so specific about just having an expansive understanding of the body and having a really clear firsthand experience of what it means to try to align your physical expression with your understanding of yourself, and how high the stakes can be around that and how political that can be. And so that's what's exciting for me about tattooing. And I think also what makes space for me to like take a step back, because when there's not a lot of somebody being represented, it puts a lot of pressure on the people who are being able to be in those spaces. And now it's cool to be like, oh, I'm not the only, you know, the only one of XYZ tattooing or in New York or what have you. And be like, there's so many other people that you can go to. You have so many choices. You have so many options. And that is something that I feel really good about.
Yes, I think that's so beautiful. I feel like it's really hard because since you entered tattooing when maybe it was a little bit more male dominated, and now you've kind of carved your own lane, you're seeing other people who also identify as non-binary or just have different gender identities enter the field in a confident way. And I think, like you said, it's just like really cool to see, because it welcomes other people to join, right? And it becomes less exclusionary. My question for you is actually like, so I don't have any tattoos, right? So, but I always thought of tattooing as like, just like for aesthetics, or like, I like this thing, so I'm gonna put it on my body, or I feel passionate about it, so I'm gonna put it on my body. But I think you have a really beautiful stance on tattooing beyond aesthetics, which it can often be just reduced to. So what do you think the power of tattooing is when it comes to self-expression and self-reflection? Because I know that you have like a really wonderful takes on this, and I just want to hear more about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so much I could say about this. It's like, where do I start? But I mean, the phrase that I always reach to is sort of the political potential of tattooing, because I think it's really important to connect it to culture and to political systems, because those are things that we're impacted by when we move through the world every single day. You know, I'm thinking about the current waves of like anti-trans legislation. I'm thinking about the overturning of Roe versus Wade. You know, there's all of these things, whether they're legal systems or belief systems or ways of being socialized, that tell you how you can and cannot exist in the world in your body, and attempt to control your body. And I think the tattooing is a really powerful space where you get to make choices about your body and you get to have agency and you get to do these, you know, these really permanent things that can shift how you exist and can shift how you exist with yourself and in relationship to yourself. And, you know, just to name a few examples that can look like, you know, people who have struggled with disordered eating, you know, it can be really significant and empowering when it comes to body dysmorphia to put a beautiful piece of artwork on a part of your body that you might have had a really complicated relationship to and get to appreciate the artistry and appreciate it as something beautiful and like really shift that relationship. You know, when it comes to like tattooing in prison, for example, people, you know, you're in a space that's controlling what you can wear, when you sleep, when you eat, when you can be outside, and having this thing that is within your control to, you know, it's something that the state can't take away from you. They can take away like photos of your family. They can take away, you know, your sneakers, but they can't take away your tattoos. That's something I hear people say over and over again. It's like, if you are experiencing housing instability or you're having to relocate or migrate, you know, tattoos are something that can travel with you and remind you of home and be this very grounding thing about who you are and your identity and where you've been in your life. You know, even when it comes to overcoming trauma, you know, for people who are survivors of trauma of different kinds or of sexual assault or interpersonal violence, tattooing can be, you know, this intervention that helps you reclaim a sense of agency and a sense of control. I mean, there's just so much there that people engage with, whether consciously or unconsciously. And a lot of my work, you know, in like the workshops that I've taught and the book that I've written is in trying to illuminate those things and bring people's attention to them, because tattooing isn't just, it can be, you know, putting a beautiful image on your skin, and it can be just that, but it can also touch all of these other ways of living, all of these other ways of existing, all of these other systems. And I think that that's so important for tattoo artists to have a consciousness around.
I am just mind blown, because when you say it, I'm like, oh yeah, of course. Like, I had never thought of it that way. And obviously, like, because I'm not immersed in it, I just don't, like, I've never had the kind of the moment to reflect on it. But when you talk about it, it just makes so much sense and kind of really paints tattooing in a completely different light for me. Obviously, like, you know, tattooing is amazing and I love to see it when it happens, but taking it beyond just like symbolism, which I think is like maybe the thing that people most gravitate towards is like, oh, this happened, so I got a symbol of this to represent it. But it can be that and so much more. Not that there's anything, you know, inherently wrong with that, but I love how you really kind of go the extra mile to like teach people like me about it and also just like speak up about all the different ways that tattooing can be really empowering in all these different scenarios, as simple or as elaborate, right? So I just think that's like, Tamara, you're so cool. So I don't know. That's all I have to say on that. But I know you work a lot with people who are incarcerated, and in relation to tattooing and in your work as an oral historian. So that to me is really intimidating, not because of the people, but because of the systems, right? So like working within the prison system and working in collaboration with people who are incarcerated seems like a really big hurdle. So can you tell me about one of your recent projects? I read all about it, but I don't have the name written down here. So if you can introduce that project and then tell me, like, how do you go about collaborating with people who are incarcerated?
Yeah. So the recent project that I did is called I Heard It Before I Ever Saw It. And it is just a collection of audio pieces from oral histories that I did with people who have experiences at the intersection of tattooing and the prison system. So, everyone that I interviewed is not currently incarcerated. They have been at some point in their lives. And that was an important logistical choice because, like you said, working with those systems is really challenging. Communication is really limited, very by design. You know, prison is meant to isolate people, and every system around accessing people who are locked up is also, you know, often privatized for profit. So if you need to like pay to send an email, paying for phone calls, you know, traveling 2 hours to visit somebody in person, like things, there's so many things that are not allowed, like cameras, recording equipment, cell phones. So, you know, those are all really difficult systems to navigate. But But the recent project, like I said, is with people who have experienced incarceration. And so we were able to just record freely, you know, in the free world. And I think it's such an important and such a rich site to look at resistance to state mechanisms of control. And people talked about that so much in the interviews that I did with them. You know, for example, one person was a tattoo artist who went to prison, and then the conditions of his release didn't allow him to work at a tattoo shop because his PO was like, "Oh, that's all criminals, criminals and gang members," or something like that is what she said. And so he had to get a different job, you know, working in a bakery, Yeah, I mean,
Who's to say bakers aren't criminals, you know?
Well, I mean, it's also like there's so much to unpack there, right? Like this definition of somebody being a criminal, like the way that certain like professions are criminalized. But yeah, you know, like one of the interviewees is a tattoo artist who owns a shop in Chicago, Faith Phillips, who owns Wish Me Luck, and she is a trans woman who learned how to tattoo in prison, and then went on to open this kind of like landmark space in Chicago. And she speaks really powerfully about being able to help people move through these experiences on the inside. You know, she tells one story about tattooing a man's grandmother's name on him when she had passed away, and it was his last living relative that he had in the outside world. And so helping him sort of process that really unique kind of grief and mourning, and being able to witness that. I've done a few projects at that intersection, and it's one that I feel really like passionate about documenting and exploring, especially because it's also underrepresented in the sort of like professional tattoo world. There's a lot of discrimination and a lot of stigma that still exists there. So it's, it's a aspect that I feel really privileged and honored to be documenting.
How do you feel like going back to school for oral history has influenced your kind of creative career? Like, in what ways do you think it's helped you like level up your work? I feel, you know, from an outside perspective, I can see the correlation in the subject matter that you're exploring, but I'm just curious, like how you feel it's benefited you, because your work is already so amazing. I'm just like curious how you're using this kind of new skill set. Before we keep on going with this amazing conversation, I need to take a little break to remind you, on the Draws in Spanish Patreon, we have an exclusive Discord community, extended episodes of every single episode of season 2, and even a monthly sticker club. So if you want to be a part of all that and so much more, become a patron of Draws in Spanish by heading over to patreon.com/drawsinspanish. Now, if you don't have the means to join the Patreon, I totally understand and no pressure, but remember, you can support the show for free by subscribing to the show on YouTube, following the show on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, and just simply sharing an episode with your friends goes a long, long way. So thank you again for listening. Thank you for your support. Now, let's get back to the show.
Well, I guess I don't necessarily feel like I went back to school with my art practice at the forefront of my mind. You know, I really was interested.
I think that's so cool. I love that, because I think people do think they have to do it that way.
Yeah. I mean, I was just interested in expanding. I was interested in tying together all of the things that I was already doing, and interested in having tools to maybe find new connections that I hadn't had before, you know. Oral history does feel like it kind of underpins everything else that I'm doing in a way that maybe wasn't visible before, but I hope is more visible now. And I'm still trying to figure out how I'm going to bring that into my art practice, to tell you the truth. I mean, it feels like a part of my practice, you know, in a really deep way, but I am still thinking about and experimenting with, you know, visual ways of mapping listening, ways to bring sound and sound installation into exhibiting work, and into sculptural work, and how to like kind of fold those into this more organic whole. And yeah, I mean, it's very new to me. I just finished this program. I'm still finishing my thesis work. So I'm really excited to like finish this big project and then just get to be a little more loose in how I think about it. But I will say that I, as much as I loved being immersed in this very academic, well, that's a really easy way to say it. Like, I really enjoyed being in this academic setting because it was so foreign to me and it was really challenging in ways that I hadn't experienced before. I also felt a lot of imposter syndrome and also felt like I was craving conversations with artists because there weren't as many visual artists in this program. And I was having a hard time figuring out like, okay, how do I use this new method, this new approach in storytelling, in art, or like what visuals can come from this?
You're in like really new territory, right? Like, few people are working on the subject matter, nonetheless, trying to like thoughtfully incorporate oral history, not just like, storytelling in a really, really like particular way and a powerful way. So I totally understand how you could feel imposter syndrome being kind of like in this academic scenario with people who maybe are like, I don't know, I'm just going to assume like a lot of writers or something. And so I could see how you feel like the odd one out. But looking for me as an outsider, looking at you and the work that you're doing, it just seems like such a kind of like obvious benefit to your work just because of the messaging and just being, and even to your craft as a tattoo artist, you know, like in everyday practice, talking to people like your clients and stuff. So I totally can see how it feels odd, but I'm really excited to see how it can like, how you're going to incorporate it, because I think you're just going to do like really powerful, even more powerful stuff, incorporating visuals in a way that a lot of other people can't, right? Like they only have the storytelling. They don't have maybe the visuals that you as an artist can like just create out of thin air.
Yeah, well, it was so valuable to be in a space with people who have really different disciplines and really different experience and perspectives, and being like, okay, what can I learn from like a journalistic approach, for example? What can I learn from like a fiction writer approach? What can I learn from, you know, this like theory approach? But I just finished a residency at Aker in Wisconsin, and it was actually so generative to be immersed in this group of artists just after finishing this MA program, because it was a really grounding reminder to be like, oh yeah, this is what the work of art and artist is. It's to have all of these different ways of processing the world, of thinking, of understanding information, of communicating. You know, it's not just about writing a paper. It's not just about, you know, recording an interview, which is like, those are ingredients, but also being like, okay, I can make a painting about this. I can make a sculpture of this. I can, you know, make a video projection of this. I can like, you know, make a Crayola crayon like scribble of this. And those are all different ways of like trying to understand something and trying to help other people see something. Because I always think about artists as bridge builders, where it's, you know, not my job as an artist to tell you what to think. But hopefully it's my job to build a new way of seeing something, or like a new way of asking a question, or a new way of seeing that can like help you come to new conclusions or illuminate something that I think needs to be illuminated. And I feel really grateful to just like have more tools at my disposal to do that.
Yes, that's what I mean. Like, I think it's so neat that you went for that tool as opposed to like a visual art tool, because you already have such a understanding of your own work, and like, you know, I know that you've worked in sculpture, you do your paintings, which if you're watching on YouTube, you can see a little preview of our paintings in the background, of their paintings in the background. But you work across so many different mediums that I think it's just like so neat to go for oral history. And I'm just so interested to see how you're going to tie that into the rest of your work, because I think it's going to be really powerful. And I think it's really interesting that like, is oral history professional podcasting? Like, I'm like, this should be reversed, Tamara, but anyway.
Well, oral history is such a cool field because it, from what I can tell as a newcomer to it, it's also evolving really rapidly. And it's a pretty new, I mean, oral, you know, storytelling has existed as long as people have existed. And But oral history as an academic and kind of like formally defined academic discipline is relatively new and kind of came about through the introduction of recording and like recording audio. And so it seems bound to change really rapidly because of changes in technology, because of, you know, for example, the pandemic, like remote recording like we're doing now is so much more common. And so there's a lot of like really rapid expansion and redefinition of oral history as a field that I can see as somebody who's new to it. And so it feels exciting to be a part of this genre when it is in flux and when it is still being defined and getting to be a part of figuring out what that looks like and learning from people who have been practicing it in really traditional ways, but also practicing it in really experimental ways and redefining what oral history even means and how it can be used. Podcasting is also really adjacent to and part of oral history too.
We're making oral history right here, right now. But Tamara, are you going to launch a Clubhouse? Isn't that what it was called? Clubhouse, that app where everything's like live?
Oh, anyway, no, absolutely.
That was a lighthearted oral history joke for you. Okay. Getting back to tattooing, I wanted to ask you if you have any advice for those interested in getting into tattooing now after listening to you. People are like, I want to get into it. I just know many things have changed since you got started, and I feel like you have a wealth of knowledge. So I'm just wondering if you have just a couple tidbits of advice.
Yeah, I don't know if I do. I mean, like you said, it's changed so much since I got into it. Sometimes I feel like I don't even have a sense of how the industry is working right now. I just kind of like stay in my little bubble and, you know, do my work with my clients and don't really know what's up with it outside of that. I had somebody ask me the other day if I thought that tattooing was oversaturated and if it was even worth getting into tattooing right now, which I think is a really good question to be asking. I think I would encourage people who are interested in tattooing to think about what they can bring to the field, you know, to like really try to take a good look at the field as it has existed and as it exists now, and think about what your place in it might be. You know, if you are only in it because you want to make money doing your illustrations, I don't think that that's enough reason, frankly, because there is so much to it beyond expressing your own artistry. It's really collaborative. It's really customer and client based. It's really about communication. It's really about relationship building. It's really about trust building. And that's something that I hope people can really see in it.
Yeah, beyond just like a practice, I do see tattooing as like a really big part of it as a service. And as a service provider, you have a lot of responsibility, just like any other service provider. And I think people can underestimate that by just being like you said, I want to get my drawings out there. But that's just like the beginning, just what's on the surface. But I also want to plug your new tattooing advice newsletter. Right?
Yeah, true.
In Search of My Body, a tattoo advice column for artists and clients. So even though, you know, on the spot, it's like, what advice do you have? You know, it's kind of like too broad of a question, but I know you have amazing advice on there. So if you want direct advice from Tamara, go ahead and subscribe to their newsletter, which I read the first one and it's really valuable on like how to find community. So there's that.
Oh, thank you. It's been so fun. It's been so fun to do the newsletter.
Yeah, I'm like, you're a wealth of knowledge. I'm sure it's just like, you don't even know the advice that you have to share. And I think what you mentioned about just like getting into it for the right reasons is a huge, like underrated piece of advice, because a lot of people do go into it just because like they saw on Instagram that like, you know, this tattoo artist is popping and they can do something similar. But like, is that really what you should be doing? You know, there's a lot of questions there. So aside from your tattoo work, I know you've been developing your own body of paintings. I know right now you've been in your master's program, so I don't know how hands-on you've been able to be with your paintings, but can you tell me a little bit about the influences for these paintings? They're like all around you right now. I just want to know more about it.
Yeah, I have been getting back into painting, which has been really nice, especially because I didn't have a studio space the whole time that I was in school. So I just moved back into one. I just moved into a new ceramic studio. So I'm like ready to hit the ground running and make a new body of work, hopefully. And yeah, the paintings that I've been making recently are sort of revisiting some earlier paintings that I made a number of years ago, where I was painting parts of this one leather jacket that I have as if they were landmasses or landscapes. And so the paintings that I've been making now are kind of trying to revisit the idea of these leather landscapes, but also imagining what else could be inhabiting these landscapes, like what kind of flora and fauna might be in this land, and also thinking about architecture and geography. And if I'm imagining these landscapes as these sort of like utopic queer spaces, then like what is between us and that space? You know, like what's between the now and the then? What kinds of like systems or fences or walls are keeping us from accessing them? And so, yeah, I've been bringing more of those aspects into the paintings and thinking through them as I'm painting, which is really fun. It's nice to be painting without a deadline or without like an end goal in mind, and just to get to process the ideas I've been having holding in my head the whole time that I've been in school.
Yes, the ideas that have been like percolating in there for a while, just like re-exploring them and finally putting them kind of to light, right? Like having them come into fruition. I am so excited for this body of work that you're creating. I know that you've shared snippets of it, and it, not like aesthetically, amazing, looks so cool. But even from like a conceptual point of view, so sick. I just love it. And can you tell me about like what you're using for these paintings? I know I've had listeners just like want to get into a little bit more of like the nitty gritty of like creating, you know, people want to know like tools and processes and like just like your process of conceptualizing maybe and then actually putting paint to canvas.
Yeah, definitely. So I paint in oils. And it's been really nice to have a studio space again for that reason, because you can work on multiple paintings at a time and kind of like, you know, while one thing is drying, work on another thing. And so that is most helpful to me, to just like have multiple things going at a time and being able to look at things all together. And I paint mostly on canvas. When I was painting sort of the original landscape series, I was working from reference photos that I was taking. So it was honestly a pretty direct, like one-to-one, like from the photo to the painting. And I would look really closely at the photos while I was painting the renderings. Now I'm sort of bringing in other things that don't have photo reference. So I'm actually using the iPad a lot, where I'll, make mock-ups of these paintings and be able to work in different layers and kind of see how different things might work. But I will say that one thing I'm trying to get away from is with tattooing, you really have to know what something's going to look like, and you have to really have things like pretty exactly dialed in. So it's like having a really finished line drawing to show a client so they know what the tattoo is going to look like. And then staying true to that in the final execution, so there's not any like weird or unexpected surprises for anybody. But I'm trying to break that habit when it comes to my paintings, because that's where so much of that experimentation and creative process happens, is in trying things, not knowing what the result is going to be and knowing that it might not work. So it's a habit that I am trying to break right now with painting.
So interesting. So interesting. Yeah. Because with tattooing, I'm assuming you use your iPad for tattooing to kind of get like the exact finished design and being able to show it to the client. And now it's like, you know, a part of your process. So it's like innate for you to want to do that for your paintings. But like you said, you lose kind of that like on the fly kind of spirit. Tamara, I just want to thank you one last time for being on the show and hanging out with me and talking to me about everything that you do. I want to ask you one last question, which is like, how can people support your art and your projects nowadays? You have so much going on. So yeah, what's the best way to support Tamara?
Right now, I think the best way is to either like sign up for my personal newsletter on my website. Subscribing to my tattoo advice newsletter is really supportive if you want that in your inbox from Substack every week. Yeah, you can buy my book, which is actually available today after not being available for some time. So it's like back on the shelves. You can get it today through Afterlife Press.
Back in stock, baby. Yes. Amazing. Of course, I'll leave everything linked below so you can follow everything, subscribe everywhere, purchase all the things. All right, Tamara, thank you so much. Okay, everyone, that's all I have for you today for this episode. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with tattoo artist, writer, and oral historian Tamara Santibanez. Their work is just so cool and interesting, and I'm just so grateful that I had the chance to talk to them. Please go ahead and check out their work over on Instagram to keep up with all their amazing projects and artwork. Now, before you go, don't go yet. I just need to remind you to subscribe to the show. Just hit subscribe, hit follow wherever you're listening. It really helps support the show. It's free and it helps me out to keep making the show for you. If you want to connect with other Latinx artists in our Draws in Spanish community, remember to head over to the new Patreon so you can join our Discord channel, get extended episodes of every conversation, including this one, and all that other good stuff. Okay, that's all I have for you. I'll see you next Tuesday with another episode. Bye. Bye, everyone.